Good afternoon, Your Honor. Clark Collins on behalf of the appellee, Mr. Ellis, Mr. Robert Ellis. I'd like to introduce to the court Michael Vogel of the firm of Allegar, Berger, and Vogel. Mr. Vogel will be presenting the argument this afternoon on behalf of Mr. Ellis. I'd like to introduce his partner, David Berger. Mr. Vogel's been admitted pro hoc vitae. Thank you.
Well, you're both welcome to the court.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Gary Trainer for Appellant Paul Taraji. I rise to introduce my co-counsel, my partner from the Prickett firm, J. Clayton Athey, and Sean Kelly from the New York firm of Arkin, Kaplan, and Rice, who has been admitted pro hoc and who will be making Mr. Taraji's argument this afternoon.
Thank you. Welcome to the court. I know that you've reserved 5 minutes. When I start the clock, you'll have a green light, and it'll change to yellow at the five-minute point, and you can keep talking, but you'll be using the time you've reserved.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Sean, but it's a different Irish name. It's Sean O'Brien, which is my last name, and I represent the appellant Paul Taraji in this matter. I'm here, and I respectfully submit that the Chancery Court's ruling was an error, principally in that the court failed to divine the reasonable expectations of the contracting parties at the time the settlement agreement was reached. And I would submit respectfully that the question here is answered quite easily. Is it unmistakably clear that this settlement agreement, entered into in July of 2005, would govern the distribution in 2009 of tens of millions of dollars in unanticipated appreciation on these four assets that were deemed to be of negligible value, appreciation which was the product primarily of work performed by Mr. Taraji in events that took place after 2005? Now, I would submit that the answer is plainly no. The agreement itself, the background facts, the transcript of the proceeding before the mediator all demonstrate plainly that the parties contemplated that the liquidation of these assets would be completed by mid-2005 or very soon thereafter. What the parties did not contemplate was a multi-year process, including oversight of these assets, additional work, and unanticipated appreciation. Nor was this agreement meant to insulate the parties against any and all conduct that they might engage in over a multi-year period after July 2005, regardless of that party's behavior or impact on the liquidation or value of the assets. Now, Mr. Ellis, the appellee, says the question is answered solely and simply by looking at one word, all. He says all means all. But that's incorrect as a matter of Delaware law. The point, as this court is aware, is to give expression to the intent of the parties at the time the agreement was reached, not to blindly apply the text. And if text alone is going to be deemed so clear and controlling, it needs to be unmistakably clear. And this court, in fact, has found ambiguity when faced with the word all in such an agreement. As we pointed out in our appellate brief, the Kuhn construction case, this court held, despite language stating that all questions arising under a particular contract would be submitted to a referee, that referee process did not apply to various disputes about payment and work performed under that contract.
You should have been here for our last argument where we were talking about the meaning of the word A.
I wish I had, Your Honor. Nonetheless, all in many instances, given background facts, different histories, and different expectations of the party, does not simply mean all. And never does this court or any other court merely rely on the word all and ignore those other factors. In the Kuhn construction case, again, I can't stress it enough, it said all questions, and this court held flat out, well, this question may have been expected by one party to fall outside of that agreement. And that was even though there's a broad policy in favor of arbitration. So in that case, all did not mean all. The Brinkerhoff case that we cited is the same. Now, I'd like to respectfully call the court's attention to an issue with our analysis of that case. We described it in our reply brief, and on page 5 of the reply brief, there is we quoted language from the Brinkerhoff case where the court said this argument does not construe the third LP agreement as a whole. We ended that with a period in preparing for oral argument. Respectfully, that should be an ellipsis. There was language that continued. The court had said it doesn't construe the agreement as a whole, and it doesn't consider the plain meaning. But nonetheless, the point is the same. In the Brinkerhoff case, what happened was there was a broad provision that said one entity has the power to do all things. And one party said, well, that means they get to do anything. But yet there was another provision, and that provision specifically applied to affiliate transactions. And Vice Chancellor Laster held that you needed to look at the agreement as a whole, and therefore the all in the broad provision did not mean all.
Well, I think that your point is that all doesn't mean all the time. That sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't. And when it does or when it doesn't depends on the context. So, again, you know, we need to talk about context here.
An excellent point, Your Honor. Or to put it another way, all means all, but the question then becomes all of what? In this case, we would submit all means all residual assets aside from the profits that are addressed in the specific other provisions, whereas Appellee would say it means all assets generated even years after the 2005 end date. So Your Honor is absolutely correct. Even the Hollinger case cited by Ellis is similar. That is the case that actually says all means all. But what happened in that case is that the court went on for many pages merely to interpret the phrase substantially all assets, and that was actually a statutory case rather than a contractual case in any event.
Well, again, and at the risk of repeating my point, we're not discussing a celestial abstraction
right
here. You know, let's get down to this case. The Vice Chancellor, interpreting the settlement agreement, concluded, whether rightly or wrongly, that the appropriate allocation of the assets that were liquidated after July of 2005 was 50-50.
Correct.
Your side claims that that was legally erroneous.
Yes.
That the allocation should have been more like, 67 to 33, 2-1 in favor of your client.
Well, right? Our client submits that the parties did not expect or bargain for or reach agreement with respect to the appropriate allocation of these profits, so they would need to be allocated in a commercially reasonable manner. Yes,
right, which he defines as somewhere close to 2-1.
I believe, Your Honor, one of the years in question by the contract was 2-1, but I don't think it was argued that that was the appropriate, the legally necessary outcome.
All right, well, be that as it
sure
may, it was something more favorable than 50-50.
It was, Your Honor.
So the question before us is why was the court's 50-50 allocation legally erroneous in these circumstances?
Certainly, for the following reason. The parties entered into this settlement agreement in mid-2005 as the result of a settlement of a dispute over the years 2003-2004, and contemplated at the time that the settlement was entered into that the liquidation would be done within days. No one contemplated, nothing in the agreement suggests that anyone contemplated, that any allocation set forth in the agreement would apply to profits generated in years well after 2005. And so the way the agreement is set up, Your Honor, at Appendix 211 and 212, there's a paragraph that refers to 2003. There's a paragraph that refers to 2004. And then there's an exhibit, Exhibit E, that is referred to. And again, it refers specifically to years 2000, and that's at A227, specifically refers to years 2001 through 2004. And then it says, to the extent management and incentive fees are earned in 2005, these fees shall be split 50-50. It doesn't say 2005 or thereafter. There's nothing in this agreement that reflects that any party contemplated that profits generated in years 2005 would be split pursuant to this agreement. There is the 7C, the residual.
Well, let's stop for a minute, if I might. Tell me if I have this correct. Basically, profits or the proceeds generated by liquidating assets fall into two categories. That is, those that are clearly covered by the agreement, the settlement agreement.
Yes.
And those that are not.
Yes.
The question, I mean, your position is that these profits that ended up being generated in 2009 were not. They're simply not covered by the agreement at all, and therefore, the court has to fashion some principle for allocating.
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
Court found that the those profits, those 2009 profits or proceeds, were covered by the contract.
It did.
And that's where we get this all means all issue. So isn't the real issue whether or not these post-July 05 proceeds or profits, if you will, are governed by the contract?
It is, Your Honor.
All right.
And in our view, the provision that the court referred to, and this is where the all means all comes up, is it's a residual provision which says all other assets, revenues, and expenses of the Caterpillar management entities shall be shared equally between Ellis and Taraji. But in our view, the way to interpret that phrase, all other assets, is meant all other assets from the period 2001 to 2005, if any, in 2005, aside from the specific profits assets that are referred to in the paragraphs A and B, which precede it. And again, the question in terms of the contracting party's intent, what was contemplated at the time this agreement was entered into?
Well, the facts indicate that what appeared to be a resolution with JB Commodities continued into 2006. Then it fell through.
Yes, sir.
You were just reading from the agreement that ended in 2005.
Yes.
Even on the agreement that looked like it was going to materialize, that was going to close in 2006, what's your client's position with regard to the year 2006?
My client's position, if it had closed in 2006, my client's position is that this agreement likely would not have applied to that transaction. Obviously, there's a need to draw a line at some point, but the question needs to be answered by what did the parties reasonably contemplate when they entered into this agreement. Once there was additional work performed, the transactions changed. It went from a pure liquidation into actually performing work and creating additional value in these assets. That became something we submit that was not contemplated in this agreement, which essentially called for a liquidation by the middle of 2005.
I do have one follow-up question.
Certainly.
To the one I asked. If the court, the Chancery Court, was correct in concluding that the settlement agreement governs these post-2005 generated proceeds, then it would follow, would it not, that that ruling should be affirmed?
Well, no, because, Your Honor, respectfully, we have the alternative argument that the court treated as a matter of law the breaches and the defense based upon the breach of the best efforts clause that we made arguments about in the lower court. That is,
putting that to one side.
Certainly.
Just on this narrow point. If that were all there was in the case.
Yes, if all there were interpreting this agreement and the conclusion was reached that it covered profits generated years after 2005, then yes, the ruling would be affirmed. But we believe there's an alternative basis, which is there were plain and clear factual issues presented in the affidavits as to whether a breach occurred and whether unclean hands was permitted to be invoked. And the court, without providing a hearing or resolving any factual disputes, merely ruled that as a matter of law, there was no such basis for finding a breach. And with respect, we don't believe the court, without holding a hearing and resolving those factual issues, which involved, yes, claims back and forth about breaches of fiduciary duty and allegations of fraud, that it's proper to resolve them without a hearing. Notably, this is not reopening the settlement. This is not going back to relitigate things that happened pre-2005 or were expected by anybody, any party, to be bound up in this settlement. These are all events and transactions that occurred years after the settlement was reached. And that's, for example, why this case is quite different from the Fox versus Payne case that's cited by Mr. Ellis. That was a case where the court enforced a settlement, but all of the underlying disputes that one party sought to raise were things that had been bound up in the settlement and existed prior to the closing of the settlement. This is quite a different case. It's an unusual case, but nonetheless, here, the reasonable expectations of the parties simply couldn't have anticipated what happened and what's at issue here. And
Can I just ask you one question?
Certainly, Your Honor.
I believe that part of the court's reasoning was that this was a settlement agreement.
Yes.
And when you already have litigation and you have a dispute and you come to terms as a way of resolving that dispute, it doesn't make sense that you would only be resolving that dispute for a short period of time, and that if matters extended, then you're right back to having no resolution.
Well, I think that was part of the court's reasoning, but this is a settlement agreement. It is a contract, and the court and the law says it's to be interpreted in accordance with contract principles. The intent of the parties, yes, was to resolve the matters. What their intent was that there would be a liquidation that would be completed in a few months. And even the whereas clause, for example, that Mr. Ellis points to, it says, whereas the parties want a comprehensive resolution of the matters settled at the mediation. So it doesn't say a comprehensive resolution forever. It says, we reached a settlement. This agreement is supposed to embody it. And everything that's at issue now that we are talking about occurred after that date in the years 2005. We are not suggesting.
But it occurred after with respect to assets that were covered by the settlement agreement, right?
That were, yes, in part covered by the settlement agreement, but were expected to be liquidated within days.
Right.
Yes, Your Honor. You are correct. But the point I'm making is that it is not an effort to relitigate the underlying facts and disputes that were meant to be resolved by this agreement. I see that I've gone into my rebuttal time, so unless there's an immediate question.
Just one.
Certainly.
The unclean hands and other equitable type arguments that I guess comprise your alternative position, in what context did they come up? What procedural context?
What procedural? In response to this motion to enforce.
There was no motion on your side.
There was no affirmative action or motion on our side.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Michael Vogel of Allegart, Berger & Vogel for the appellee, Robert Ellis. This is a case that was settled in 2005. As I'm sure your honors are aware from the argument, this was a contentious dispute between the co-founders of a private equity fund. And in fact, one of the central issues in dispute was the allocation of profits going forward. And it's in the pleadings. Mr. Taraji, or my client, made a claim in the complaint that there had been a 50-50 allocation of profits agreed to. Mr. Taraji did not dispute that in his answer, but asserted a counterclaim that there had been an amendment orally to the first oral agreement that it would be 80-20 on a going-forward basis. So that was squarely presented by the pleadings in this case. How are these partners going to divide their profits on a going-forward basis? Ultimately, with the help of Vice Chancellor Strine, this was settled, again, a contentious case. And the intention embodied in the written agreement was that this would be a, quote, comprehensive, definitive, and superseding agreement. Right on page 2 in the whereas's clauses, we are going to be done with litigation. And to that end, the precise issue that was at the core of the dispute, the allocation of profits, was resolved in Section 7 of the settlement agreement. Section 7A says for the year 2003 it will be 50-50. Section 7B in 2004, Mr. Taraji will get 62.5%. My client will get 37.5%, so partway between the two positions. And then Section 7C, the one we've been talking about, all other assets, revenues, and expenses will be divided 50-50. So there's a clear residual clause that puts an end to further disputes concerning that issue of the allocation of profits.
Mr. Vogel, yes. Just one question on that subject. It's been contended that the parties contemplated that all of this liquidation would be finished by 2005 or in 2005. That's either correct or it isn't. But does any is that a dispositive issue?
No. No, it's not a dispositive issue, Your Honor, because we can address that on the face of the settlement agreement as to what the parties' intentions were with respect to that litigation. And the settlement agreement is very clear. It says the parties will make best efforts to complete the liquidation by July 31, which was actually a Sunday. The settlement agreement was signed Thursday evening, July 28th. And there are several places in the agreement, I think three that are quoted in my brief, where the parties say if the liquidation is not completed by that Friday, July 29th, 2005, and then certain consequences attach. So plainly on the face of it, the parties agree we're going to use best efforts to do that, but that may not happen, and then we will have certain consequences if that doesn't happen.
Well, but doesn't the fact that there was mention of a date only a few days after the execution of the agreement suggest strongly that the parties expected if we can't manage this date, we're still talking about the very near future. We're talking about weeks or months at most, not years.
Well, certainly the intention was to do this quickly. However, the notion that it was absolutely unthinkable or beyond the contemplation of these parties that it might take more than weeks and it might take months, it might take into a calendar year beyond the end of 2005, which I think was the weight of Justice Holland's question earlier in the argument, that was certainly not unthinkable. There's nothing in the agreement that says any consequence occurs if we go past December 31st, 2005. We have sophisticated parties who are in private equity who know that sometimes illiquid investments may take a little bit of time to liquidate. So there's no question. There's no consequence in the agreement to going past that date. But yes, that was the hope and that was the goal, that people would use best efforts and try to do this quickly.
Well, as you know, your opponent says the reason you went beyond the date is attributable to the unclean hands of your client, and that to that extent there should have been a hearing. Why was it unnecessary to have a hearing in this case?
I will address that, but if I may, in just responding to that, I think it's important analytically to keep that argument separate from the issue of contract interpretation. To the extent that my adversary's argument claims simply because we went past the end of 2005 the agreement fails, that argument has to stand or fall without regard to fault.
I understand, okay. And I think that's been conceded.
Okay, fair enough. With respect to the argument concerning fault, I think the issue is that as a matter of law, they haven't pled enough either to establish a breach of contract or a breach of contract that would support a defense. And there are several reasons for that. First, and this is independently sufficient, but it's not the only reason, as Vice Chancellor Laster found, what they have alleged on their face, even if it's all true, are simply a question of business disputes. They don't rise to the level as a matter of law of a breach of contract to use best efforts or unclean hands. And to give you, I think, probably the most concrete example of that, the one that they claim is the most severe, where we, quote, threw a fatal wrench into the deal with JB Commodities. JB Commodities had originally made a proposal on four positions, total price about $13 million. And then JB Commodities, a number of months later, I think it's approximately 6 months later, comes back and says, we'd only like to buy three positions, and those happen to be the ones for which the bid was smallest. So we'd like to buy those three positions for about $5 million. That other $8 million is no longer on the table. And Mr. Ellis said, no, that's not acceptable. You're cherry-picking. In fact, we've had 6 months' period of time where there have been positive developments. There was a very large unexpected dividend for one of those three positions that they still wanted to buy. And you're saying, well, look, 6 months later, our bid for three of these looks great. We want to do that. And the bid that was expensive, we don't want to do that. Mr. Ellis said, that's no longer a good deal. We've given them a free option. In addition, we still have to retain an investment bank to help us sell these assets. We might as well get an investment bank to sell all four of them, which will be much more appealing to the investment bank to take on as a project, and we'll get the benefit of their expertise on all four of them. That, Your Honors, is the core of what a business dispute is. What assets are we going to sell, when, at what price? That's exactly what a business dispute is. That's not unclean hands. That's not a breach of best effort.
But your alternative position, if I understand it from your brief, is that even if it was unclean hands or a failure to negotiate or, you know, to make best efforts, the other side profited to the extent of its percentage of $100 million.
Precisely, Your Honor. And in fact, that's what happened. And just to elaborate, there was no cause of action brought for breach of contract, no complaint seeking damages, because, of course, there were no damages. The statute of limitations expired sometime in 2009, and now we're fighting over the $20 million incentive fees that resulted from JB Commodities not going through.
Can we go back for a moment to the contract interpretation issue? I'm going to ask you the flip side of the same question that I asked your opponent. You know, either the proceeds that were generated after 2005 are covered by the settlement agreement or they're not. If they are not, which is Mr. Taraji's position, then you know, one needs to locate some sort of principle to decide how you allocate those proceeds, and his principle is commercial reasonableness, and they attempt to define that. Let's assume hypothetically, that post 2005 liquidation proceeds fall outside the contract. Your side also would be searching for some principle of allocation, would it not? And what would that be?
I'd be happy to address what that principle would be, Your Honor. And as an introduction, I cited an 1834 decision of this court, the Raybould decision in my briefs, which says courts will not undertake to determine the allocation of profits between partners based on their unequal contributions. And I was taken to task because it's prior to the modern corporate statutes that involve general partnerships rather than limited partnerships. But it really wasn't designed to address those things. It was designed to address what is it that courts do with respect to partnerships. And what courts do is they enforce agreements. They may find facts. They may determine whether specific objective criteria have been met. But I think the Raybould Court in 1834 was saying what courts really don't do is try to decide who contributed to the success of a business. That's something we let business people do, and we let business people decide. So the question is, ultimately, it really wouldn't go back to this commercial reasonableness amorphous trial as to who did a good job managing these assets. We'd go back to partnership law. And, in fact, what happened in this case is there was a partnership agreement. It's uncontested. It was 50-50. There's a question of fact below as to, or in the original case, as to whether it was changed. That was settled, and that agreement was vacated by the settlement agreement, by the superseding agreement. So we can't go back to that agreement regardless of whether it's 50-50 or 80-20. And so what we do, ultimately, is we go back to default partnership law. And default partnership law says 50-50. And I think, if I had to speculate, that's probably why we ended up with this commercial reasonableness theory in the first place, because throwing out the contract really is a matter of law. The settlement really wouldn't help them. We still end up at 50-50.
Which is what the court determined, but it determined that by virtue of the settlement agreement, correct?
Precisely, Your Honor. The court below determined it on the basis.
So at least from your perspective, you would be content with a holding that the trial court was correct and the contract governed and you get 50-50, or even if the contract didn't apply, 50-50 is an appropriate resolution there being no contract in effect for this period?
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Vogel will take a win any way he can.
Did I say that fast enough?
So was there any discussion at any level about quantum merit from the other side? You know, that they had earned a disproportionate share of the money and they should be compensated accordingly?
Well, that phrase I don't believe was used below or in the appellate papers. I suppose there's some flavor of that in the argument that we contributed more. And to clarify the record, opposing counsel indicated they were only looking at what they contributed after the settlement. In fact, in the papers below, the argument was we contributed more to the origin of these investments, to the management of these investments, all of that.
Your client was the weak link in the partnership, according to them.
Absolutely. That was their argument. And that was, if you read their counterclaim below, that was their theory below for why it was changed to 80-20. My client had to take a period of less work due to his daughter's illness, and he claimed that there was an agreement as a result of that to change the allocation. And we contested that, but it was the dispute below, and that is the argument now. I'd like to address briefly those two decisions that counsel spoke about during oral argument this morning. Those were first raised in the reply brief, so I haven't had a chance to address those in my papers. One of them was the Kuhn construction case from this court last year, and they argue that that says that all doesn't necessarily mean all of the time, and more to the point, they say that I say it does and you can't look at the rest of the agreement. I want to be clear, I'm not claiming you don't look at the agreement as a whole. My point is you look at the agreement as a whole, but in doing that, certain provisions, ones that are directly applicable, do take on great importance in deciding the dispute in front of us. Second, I would note that Kuhn really wasn't a case about the meaning of all. Kuhn was a case about the meaning of questions. And Kuhn involved a case where there was a referee clause in a construction contract which said all questions will be decided definitively by the head of the defendant as referee. And the defendant argued that constitutes an arbitration clause as to which all issues are going to be referred. And this court responded no, and it didn't respond in terms of all, it responded in terms of questions. And it said, well, questions isn't defined, but claims is defined in that contract, and claims is, in fact, what we have here. We also see that there are standard arbitration provisions that have been removed from this agreement, and that referee clause doesn't use the term arbitration. And most importantly, the agreement had a specific provision saying there will be exclusive jurisdiction of disputes in the state and federal courts of Delaware. So there were very clear provisions there that said there are kinds of issues or disputes that may arise that are not questions. So there's no question that if something was a question, it would be under that provision. However, some things aren't questions. So it's really actually directly not on point at all in that regard. And likewise, I'd like to address the Brinkerhoff case, which is a decision of the Chancery Court, also from 2010. And that case, I think, also by Vice Chancellor Laster, and really, I think, puts an exclamation point on what he said in our case. In the Brinkerhoff case, there was a provision that said management may make all decisions in its own discretion. But then it had a separate specific provision that said, but if you're going to have a related party transaction, and I'm paraphrasing, there are other requirements that apply. And the party that was challenged said, well, I can rely on this provision that says all decisions I can make in my discretion. And the Chancery Court said, no, there's a more specific provision that applies to this specific situation. That's precisely what Vice Chancellor Laster said in this case. Once we have that provision that says all other assets, what we would expect to see is not a provision that doesn't happen to mention future years, but we'd expect a specific carve-out like we had in Brinkerhoff. He didn't refer to Brinkerhoff, but we'd expect to have a specific carve-out. That's what they had in Brinkerhoff, and that's what we don't have in this case. So those cases, neither of them are controlling or adverse to our position. All right, I think I've addressed the critical points of my outline. Are there other matters that...
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Very briefly, Your Honor. With respect to the agreement at issue here, Exhibit E, which is said in the agreement to be the dispositive provision, there's a specific provision addressing 2001 through 2004. And then there's a clause at the end that says, to the extent management and incentive fees are earned in 2005, these fees are split 50-50. There is no 2005 or thereafter. And as counsel, I believe, conceded, the intention here was to get this liquidation done very quickly. And if the question is put, did anyone, the vice chancellor who was doing the mediation, any of these parties, or the parties that drafted a phrase, to the extent management and incentive fees are earned in 2005, any of those people contemplate the distribution and generation of millions of dollars of profits in 2009 based upon additional work for years? The answer is no. The parties did not contemplate that, and therefore the all in all other assets could not have been meant to apply to that. What it meant to apply to was any residual nonprofits assets for the years that were specifically covered by the agreement. And with respect to the what counsel called business disputes, well, these are business disputes. But what the court didn't do is have what the court is supposed to do when there's a business dispute, have a hearing, find facts, find out if Mr. Ellis was the actor in good faith or not.
Well, Mr. O'Brien, even if your argument is correct, Mr. Vogel's response is it's a non-starter because we end up in the same place. Even if the section of the contract that resulted in the 50-50 allocation doesn't apply, you end up with default rules of partnership law, which, again, would involve a 50-50 split. What is your response?
My response is that I don't think the law demands, in this case, a default 50-50 split, that the court can apply and look for a commercially reasonable allocation of these profits between the parties. That I agree with counsel.
But commercially reasonable is in the eye of the beholder. Where do you come up? What is the source of the allocation that your side argues for?
The court, I believe, would find facts as to who actually did contribute what and would probably make the inquiry as to what the parties might have agreed to.
So we have a whole new litigation.
Well, we have a litigation. I wouldn't call it a whole new litigation. It is a dispute, Your Honor, over events that occurred after 2005, and it is a business dispute. And it is another dispute, yes, but it is not the dispute that was settled in this case, and it's not something, respectfully, that was contemplated or agreed to by these parties who entered into the settlement agreement in the middle of 2005.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both. The court will take this matter under advisement, and we will adjourn.